All right, well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Friday edition of American Woo-hoo! Hit Radio. Yeah, it's Friday here.
Friday, WHPC. The real happy hour.
Absolutely. WHPC 90.3 FM is where we are broadcasting from, coming out of Nassau Community College in Garden City, New York.
In the bowels of...
The building.
Of the building.
Of the campus. We're here every Wednesday and Friday at this time from 5 until 6 p.m. The Friday version of our show, we call it How Music Changed. And last week, we just started our coverage of the one and only, the truly great, nobody to compare him to, Mr. Louis Armstrong. Our first show, as I said, was last week. And in 1 hour, we got up to the point of Louis's life. He's still a teenager. And in that entire hour, we didn't even get to the point in his life where he has even recorded a single song yet. That's how colorful his life was. If you missed that show. The last
we heard, he was making friends with a calliope player.
Yes, Fate Marable. In fact, let's pick up exactly right where we did leave off. Louis, as in the first part of our story, he was in New Orleans for his entire life, had no real intention to leave New Orleans, loved the city, and felt that there was no good reason for him to leave. As I said, he had not recorded, but that wasn't that unusual. Because the year was, 1918, 1919.
Yeah, people thought it was going to steal their soul or something like that. Not quite, but
you're right. It was like that Indian idea of like what photography would be like. People were afraid of recording. And it really was just so crude that not many people even considered it to be worthwhile from a commercial aspect. So Louis is playing it. And I guess one thing I really want to convey more than anything else is what he really got from his time in New Orleans. Besides, of course, developing the culture and being around the music that was there all of the time, the main way that it affected him was in his sense of showmanship, what was happening in New Orleans. Because everybody thinks of Louis as being this gregarious guy and the personality that he had. That all goes back to his days as a teenager in New Orleans, when he was being basically growing up and starting his time as a musician. The whole point of a New Orleans musician was not just to play the music, but to put on a show, to be a part of entertainment, to get people to come in to wherever you were playing.
Yeah, almost
like a barker.
Yeah, like a barker, exactly.
So
that was the word I was looking for. Thank you.
Louis needed to be not only a great player, but he needed to have the personality of a barker, to get people to want to come into the bar to hear what they were doing. And although it's very uncommon now, back in those days, it was very common for the leader of the band to be a boisterous singer and a bit of an actor and a cut-up to get attention. Louis watched everybody else doing this, especially the most successful bands, and realized that this is something that he had to incorporate into his own personality. So that is what he began to do. Now, the best offer that he had at this point, he was playing with Kid Ory in an orchestra with Kid Ory. King Oliver, who was in New Orleans, that was his mentor, had left to go to Chicago. Kid Ory took over the band, but he needed a trumpet player to take King Oliver's place. So that's what Louis was doing in the city. Meanwhile, Fate Marable has a gig on the riverboat on the Mississippi, going up and down the river. He hears Louis and offers Louis a job. Louis takes the job, and he learns a whole new series of talents now.
Right, he had to learn how to read charts, right?
Learn how to read, exactly. Now, reading is important with this band because this band is a little bit, it's a riverboat. And they're playing to a more sophisticated crowd than would have been coming into the nightclubs and the whorehouses where Louis was originally playing.
Right, these are people with white gloves.
It's certainly much more sophisticated, absolutely. So Louis is learning to read now, and he's playing with Fate Marable on the riverboat. And they're actually playing around the New Orleans area, taking the music upriver to different cities and things like that. And I want to read this one account now. This is an account that is actually from Jack Teagarden. Now, Jack Teagarden is a famous trombonist from, I guess, also from the 20s and the 30s. And at this point, the year, I believe, I think we can pinpoint this sometime around maybe 1919. And Jack Teagarden himself is a teenager, and he's in the French Quarter, which is to say very close to the river in New Orleans, looking for you know, just walking around, and this is the account. He had been wandering around the French Quarter with a pal, both of them drunk, when he suddenly heard a trumpet in the distance. What else is he doing in New Orleans? Of course he's drunk in the French Quarter. I couldn't see anything but an excursion boat gliding through the mist back to port, he remembered. Then the tune was more distinct. The boat was still far off, but in the bow, I could see a Negro standing in the wind, holding a trumpet high, and sending out the most brilliant notes I had ever heard. I don't even know if it was Tiger Rag or Panama, but it was Louis Armstrong descending from the sky like a god. The ship hugged the bank as if it were driven there by the powerful trumpet beats. I stayed absolutely still, just listening, until the boat dropped anchor. It was Fate Marable's orchestra. I talked with the musicians when they landed, and Fate Marable presented me to the unknown cornetist with a round, open face, Louis Armstrong. So there you go. Of course, now Louis Armstrong, here he is making such incredible impressions that a guy like Jack Teagarden actually thinks that Louis sounds like a god descending from heaven. Louis kind of dug Jack, too. Jack was a good trombone player even then, and they'd play for each other, and Louis said that he really liked what Teagarden was doing at that time. Now, while playing with Marable's orchestra, this is where Louis met drummer Baby Dodds and the banjo guitarist Johnny Sancier. These are guys who go on to be very important in Louis's career. Now, before we move on and get to the section of the story where we move out of New Orleans, let's play a song that dates from, of course, in the future part of Louis's career, but at least it has a lot to do with his time in New Orleans because it's about a street in New Orleans. Let's hear Louis Armstrong's version of Basin Street Blues.
Thank you. certainly one of my favorite Louis Armstrong recordings. And I could go further than that and say that when I hear that, it wells me up almost. It's such a beautiful track. It's one of my favorite recordings of all time. Louis Armstrong with Basin Street Blues.
It's amazing how strong and clear and concise his notes are, you know? It's just...
The tone is so rich and full, and yet the imagination that you hear coming out of him, it just sparkles in every way because you just hear this lively personality just discovering almost for himself as he's playing. It's like he's almost finding things immediately on the spot, which is just so brilliant. Now, I'm going to be reading a few different quotes today, and I should mention that the quotes that I'm reading are coming from this excellent book about Louis Armstrong's life. It's called Louis Armstrong, An Extravagant Life, and it's by Lawrence Bergreen. And I'd like to read from this now about an account about Louis's voice, which they say dates from his time back then when he was in New Orleans. Here's the book. From his mother, Louis inherited a powerful conviction that you saw a doctor but twice in your life, when you were born and when you died, and sometimes not even then. Over the years, Louis would develop some exotic ideas about physic, but for now, he simply relied on a nostrum known as Scott's emulsion, which he consumed by the bottle. He had a cold all the time, Baby recalled of Louis. That's Baby Dodds, the drummer that he had met in Fate Marable's band. Uh-huh. And we used to kid him around, laughing and joking. Once he took a whole course of Scott's emulsion. It cleaned him out perfectly. Large doses of Scott's emulsion proved useless against the common cold, though. Louis became so sick and his voice so raspy that he was convinced he had developed tuberculosis and was sure to die. Eventually, he got rid of the cold, but the voice developed like that, and he's been like that ever since. That's Baby Dodds talking about Louis. Hmm. Now, as I said, Baby Dodds is the drummer in Fate's band. He's worth noting because Baby Dodds has also had done so much in the course of music history, I should at least mention. He's one of the guys who's responsible for putting the drum set together, for figuring out a way to use foot pedals and snare drums and stuff in a way that you could actually sit and play a kit, which was a fairly new idea. People had to invent these things, and Baby Dodds was one of the guys that was actually doing that so he could sit down and play with the orchestra. And
interesting.
A real innovator
there. Before, it was like, you'd have marching bands, and there'd be one guy with a bass drum.
Cymbal and a bass drum player and a snare drum player. It took guys like Baby Dodds to figure out how to put this all together so that one guy could sit down with a band or an orchestra and do it. And he was one of the major innovators to come up with what is still being used in bands
by
just about anybody. Yeah. If you're a drummer, you play a drum kit. And you thank Baby Dodds for having, many of the ideas that were developed.
I did not know that.
Well, let's see. Now, you can imagine, considering that Louis is now on the steamboat going up and down the Mississippi River, how the New Orleans style of music slowly spread out of that city and up the Mississippi River, via the steamboat orchestras.
To St. Louis and points beyond.
Right. Jazz, basically was the rock and roll of its, or the rap of its day. This is music that wasn't even being called jazz yet, really, by very many people. But there's this interesting coverage here from the Times-Picayune. Heidi, you, of course, know that. It's the main paper.
That's where my birth announcement was.
In the Times-Picayune. There you go. Well, this is what I'd like to read this from that same book on Louis's life, because I think this is very telling about what the times were like. During Louis's stint with the orchestra, Fate Marable gradually changed the face of jazz, at least outside New Orleans. Hardly anyone was calling it jazz yet, not even the musicians who played it. They called it New Orleans-style music, or even ragtime, because of its kinship to the piano rags of Scott Joplin. In parts of the country where religion was a potent force, even Joplin's tranquil little sonatas were considered suspect. On June 17, 1917, when jazz, by then called jazz with two S's, was about to become a national craze, the New Orleans Times-Picayune, the voice of that city, inveighed against this degenerate form of music. Its editorial, entitled Jazz and Jazzism, made an ism out of the music to equate it with modern evils like communism and Bolshevism. Why is the jazz music, and therefore the jazz band, this is the article, as well ask why is the dime novel or the grease-dripping donut? All are manifestations of a low streak in man's taste that has not yet come out in civilization's wash. The paper's editorial writer declared that jazz belonged, quote, down in the basement of the House of Music in the Servants' Hall of Rhythm. The Times-Picayune declared that the main problem was the unfortunate emphasis on rhythm.
On certain natures, the paper theorized, loud sound and meaningless noise has an exciting, almost intoxicating effect, like crude colors and strong perfumes, the sight of flesh or the sadistic pleasures in blood. As a remedy, the Times-Picayune prescribed the languor of a Viennese waltz or the refined sentiment of an 18th century minuet. At the same time, the newspaper was forced to acknowledge that jazz originated in New Orleans. However, we do not recognize the honor of parenthood, but with a story in circulation, it behooves us to be the last to accept the atrocity in polite society. And where it has crept in, we should make a point of civic honor to suppress it. Its musical value is nil, and its possibilities of harm are great. So you can see.
They were treating it just like rock and roll.
Just like rock and roll or rap, man. And that's what was going down at that time. People were just, you know, kind of not really cool about
this. Signs of drunken depravity.
Now, while the New Orleans papers, you know, were ragging, pun intended, I guess, on this traditional New Orleans style of music, at almost precisely, you know, the same time, a rather ordinary group of New Orleans musicians called the Original Dixieland Jazz Band was selling out and inciting near riots of excitement in New York City.
Huh.
This is a bunch of white guys who had moved, who had gone to New York from New Orleans, taking some of the styles that they had learned there and bringing it to New York, claiming that they had invented it wholesale, cut from whole cloth.
Sure, they did.
They just invented the whole thing. They were lucky enough to be the first band technically to record a jazz track, and it ended up becoming an absolute rave in New York.
It
was the birth of the jazz age, literally the absolute birthday, more or less. We covered this event actually in an earlier show when we did the birth of jazz. So if you go back through our history of how music changed, you'll hear the coverage of that exact story. Basically, what they played, the original Dixieland Jazz Band, was like a hectic 2-4 rhythm, strictly played in an ensemble style. Everybody more or less playing at the same time over the chord changes. It was like, it sounded like total cacophony and noise.
It was a train wreck.
People didn't know how to dance to it or anything, but it was actually amazingly exciting and interesting for what it was presenting as far as being so different from the normal European style of music that was around at that time. Now, meanwhile, on the riverboats, the orchestra arrangements that Fate Marable was playing and Lewis playing with him, they allowed for little improvisation. So it had to compensate, because Lewis was obviously a brilliant improviser, so they would give him time to ad lib between choruses. In a sense, it was at that exact moment on the riverboat when the jazz solo was born.
Right.
While the band played through its changes, Lewis soloed and made up new melodies just to extend the song. This eventually caused enough tension within the band that eventually Lewis and the hyperactive drummer, Baby Dodds, were asked to resign from the band because it was causing so much trouble. So Lewis's life at this point now, they suddenly had to work for the riverboats, almost returned to business as usual, fighting with his wife, nearly getting killed, you know, working overtime, working too hard, back to playing with Kid Ory when he could, until August 1922, at which point everything changed with one telegram. Lewis's life and the history of jazz, the history of American music, can be neatly divided into before and after this telegram. It's really that simple. Came from Chicago, and it came from Lewis's mentor, King Oliver.
King Oliver, yes.
Now, remember, as can be proven by the reaction of New York to the Dixieland Jazz Band and any other number of signs, the world at large was ready.
Yeah, the pump was primed.
And due to all of Lewis's experiences in New Orleans that he had had as a person, he now is pretty much embodying the very spirit of this music more than any other human being. He's exactly the right age because he's young. He's got the full experience of what was being developing around him. He's just, he's the right man for the time, and there's nobody else on the planet like him. Now, Lewis, like I said, by circumstance and, you know, unconsciously, due to all of his personal experience that you know, we've covered up until now, he literally embodied the spirit of jazz. And by telegram, Papa Joe asked Lewis to come to Chicago and join his group. No hesitation. Not even a moment. Lewis, you know, read the note,
said,
looked up at the
pack my bags.
Looked up at his bandmates and said, "Bye, everybody. I'm going to Chicago. Papa Joe asked for me. I'm going." That's how much he thought of Papa Joe. And when he got figured he's asking for him personally by telegram, that's all that he needed. Now, Lewis has got to say goodbye to some of his friends, and This is another thing about Lewis. Now, he tends to take a lot of advice from people who he knew closely. A lot of them were rough types.
Mm.
We're talking bouncers, pimps, guys like that. People who wouldn't have hesitated to have basically, you know, pulled a knife or
people
or
who are street savvy.
So at the club Matrangas, which was that, you know, very shady club where Lewis mm-hmm. was trying to play from time to time, he broke the news of his impending departure to Slippers, the bouncer, who had a deep appreciation of jazz and Lewis's music. This is Lewis talking. When he found out that I was leaving for Chicago, he was the first one to congratulate me. And while he shook my hand, here are the words that he said, which I shall remember till the day I die. And I'm going to clean this up. When you go up north, Dipper, be sure and get yourself a white man that will put his hand on your shoulder and say, this is my Negro. Although he didn't say Negro. Those were his exact words. Lewis never forgot this advice, for Slippers was a crude son bitch, but he loved me and my music. So there you go. So this is important because you got to remember now that in the future, when we get to Lewis's entanglements with his management later on, this is going to matter. So it's goodbye to May Ann, his mom, his sister, Mama Lucy, Clarence, the son that he had adopted. Good riddance to Daisy, his wife. And goodbye to Matrangas, the Tuxedo Brass Band, Papa Celestin. Goodbye, Kid Ory, Fate Marable, Memories of the Waif's Home. Goodbye, parades and wagon gigs and funerals. After a short train ride, well, a long train ride and a short cab ride, all of a sudden, there he is in Chicago, and there's Joe Oliver and his band. In the band, when Lewis arrives in Chicago, already there is Baby Dodds.
Oh, awesome.
The same drummer that got kicked out with him. Uh-huh. So he's... knows somebody.
Reunited.
He's nervous, but he's you know, wow, I know some of these guys. Johnny Dodds, the incredible, you know, player, also on clarinet, now sitting in with the band. Honor Dutry, and a girl piano player named Lil Hardin. This is worth mentioning because she was introduced to Little Lewis, as they all called him when he showed up, because they all still thinking of him as the little kid.
Right.
That's how they all met. Lewis was not even a teenager when he first got to know King Oliver. And she kept her first impressions to herself, though. But this was her reaction. Little? He weighed about 230. He was fat. He dressed like a country bumpkin in a starched overall jumper. His hair was ridiculous. He had bangs that stuck straight out from his head. Soon, though, and together, they would become the very first couple of this new music, now called jazz. Now, I could go on a little bit longer, but I want to play one more song, so just to cover the story. I'm going to play this track. It's a little bit out of sequence. You're going to tell how old it is, though, when you hear it. And the reason I want to play this track now, it's called Zulu's Ball. This is most likely the most rare record in existence in the world today. It was only rumored to have existed for any number of years. And when the interest in Louis Armstrong became intense, of course, the search to see if this record really did exist became intense. Eventually, somebody did find one copy of this record printed in California, and it is the only known copy to exist. So there is only one piece of shellac that has this song on it. And because of that, every version that anybody has of this song has it because somebody recorded the shellac 78 RPM record the one time they were willing to play it, and that's all that the rest of us have. It's that rare. It's worth a fortune, and you're going to be able to tell how old it is when you hear it. Here is that track by King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band called Zulu's Ball. Thank you.
obviously a track very much played in the ensemble style. Not a lot of soloing there, but or maybe a lot at the same time, but an amazingly rare recording, that Zulu's Ball. It's King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band. By the way, it's funny, just since, as an aside note, it's funny that they're called the Creole Jazz Band, as there wasn't a single Creole in the band. None of them were Creole. They were all, you know, black musicians from New Orleans with not Creoles. But Creole music was what was popular because it was what high society was looking for. So by putting that in their name, they figured it might actually have some draw. I don't know if it mattered at all in Chicago. But maybe because they were a jazz band and Creole, it gave them maybe a cachet to look like they could maybe cover anything that they wanted to. Well, anyway, we're talking about Lil Hardin earlier. And in many ways, it's worth talking about Lil a little bit more because she was everything that Lewis wasn't from a personality perspective. She was a properly trained pianist who had taken lessons, and she had, you know, was properly educated. And she was very slender. She was sophisticated. Lewis certainly wasn't that. She was worldly and very immodest, which, again, very unlike Lewis. Lewis was one of the most modest guys you could meet. And she was outwardly ambitious. Lewis even couldn't believe that he left New Orleans. If it wasn't for King Oliver, Joe Oliver, he never would have left even New Orleans. He did not have any ambition to go anywhere. He just wanted to stay in his home. But Joe Oliver's the one who brought him away. Now, Will had already been hired, underage no less, as the pianist for the New Orleans Creole Jazz Band. And this was, though, before Joe Oliver had even arrived to join the band himself. She had been brought in because she was working in a music store teaching people how to, you know, the sheet music in the stores. And some of the band members came in and they said, hey, you're all right, you could join our band. Even though she was underage, they were able to sneak her in for the gigs.
Yeah, they gave her a dispensation.
Right. Now, trumpeter Sugar Johnny was the original player of, you know, the trumpet player, but he had caught pneumonia and died suddenly.
Oops.
Left him with that. That was the thing that originally brought King Oliver to Chicago, thinking he had a possibility to get in there, and he did. So, you know, all pro all the way. That's Joe Oliver, and a taskmaster. It wasn't long before he was able to take over the band, make it his immediately, and he started to he fired the people in the band that he didn't like or the ones that he considered lazy, but Lil survived and even toured the country with the band. They ended up going to San Francisco, et cetera. The band was making a considerable name for itself. So now Lewis is up there with these folks, and he's nervous. He's really nervous. He feels like he might be a little bit
out
of his league. And he's wondering if he's going to be able to fit in with everybody, especially with Joe Oliver, because he thinks the world of him. This guy was his hero. Now, Will also was everything that Lewis's wife, Daisy, wasn't. You know, most obviously, you know, she was an insider in his world as a musician.
Right.
So this made her very interesting to Lewis as a woman. But also now you have to consider Chicago around 1920 to get the full understanding of the story. The influx of Southern blacks that had come from the South to Chicago had increased tenfold.
Sure, people were looking to the factories for work.
Right, all of a sudden, you know, basically, of course, the Northern factories were just attracting people to get good jobs, paying jobs.
Right.
And, you know, in the South, people were still basically living through Jim Crow.
A lot of people were sharecropping and things of that nature that just wasn't going to get you anywhere. If you wanted to move up in life, you had to move out.
So the population of Chicago, the black population, literally increased by a factor of, you know, tenfold. 10 times as many in the first few years of the 1920s, which literally changed the complexion of the city. Prohibition kicked in at about the exact same time.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, drinking is illegal. But Chicago, probably more than any other city in the United States, totally flaunted its disregard for the law. Speakeasies doubled after the law was enacted. And with so many places to buy illicit booze, that meant that there was a lot of places for bands to work. So jazz started to provide the soundtrack for the speakeasy era, thus the jazz age is the way that all came into happening. It also provided the sole means for a mingling of the races. It was a chance for white people and black people to get together to listen to music together and hang out, which was actually, you know, for once, finally, something which is going to offer some sense of peace. For the most part, anyway. As would be his fortune, Lewis arrives in Chicago at the perfect time with the perfect combination of talent and personality.
Hmm.
He was not one to show off or to cut anybody. Now, in New Orleans, that is the style of most New Orleans musicians.
Oh, yeah.
They play, you know, you heard stories.
You know firsthand.
Absolutely. You know, like we told stories earlier of people playing out the window trying to call, you know,
The
like players.
Barkers.
Exactly. Trying to get people to leave one club to come to the other. And if two people were playing together side by side, one would absolutely try to outplay the other person. Lewis didn't like to do that. He wasn't one to challenge anybody. So he really wouldn't show up for cut unless he was challenged. Then he would tear the roof
then it
off
was on.
Rather than let anyone humiliate him. And there are many famous players that tried to do this. There's one incredibly interesting story of Freddie Keppard, the famous trumpet player who knew Lewis in New Orleans, who had gotten famous on his own. And Freddie Keppard had the temerity to show up at a club in Chicago where Lewis was playing, and he literally took Lewis's horn out of his hands.
Oh.
And played to show him that's the way it's done. When he finished, Lewis took the horn back from Keppard and blew Keppard right out of the building. Keppard absolutely left and never came back. It was it. And there's a lot, all the witnesses say it was truly unbelievable to watch that happen. Without even necessarily knowing it, Louis Armstrong embodied this whole combination of the laid-back feel of New Orleans with the citified hardness of Chicago. And in the process of incorporating all of this, he already changed the very nature of jazz, and he didn't even record anything yet. Already the music had changed due to him. Finally, though, on April 5th and 6th, 1923, we get to the point in our story where there is recorded evidence.
Let's hear it.
Right. This is perfect. Of course, King Oliver and his band, the Creole Jazz Band, had found that there was a recording studio in Richmond, Virginia, that they could go to record. And they took the trip down there. The room was no better than a shack. It was on the side of a railroad track, so they had to time their recordings for when the trains weren't going by, and they were freighters, so they really had to worry about when the trains were going by because it mattered a lot.
That's an hour.
They had to, basically, there's no such thing as microphones yet, so they are literally standing around a room playing into a horn, and it's such a new thing, they'd barely know what to do, where people should go, because Lewis is so loud. They figured that Lewis has got to stand away. So Lewis has got to stand about 15 to 20 feet in back of everybody while they record their first tracks. And this song is the very first song recorded on the very first recording session ever by Mr. Lewis Armstrong, track called Just Gone. Thank you. That is Joe King Oliver and the Creole Jazz Band featuring Louis Armstrong, Lil Hardin, Honor Dutre, Johnny Dodds, Bud Scott on banjo, Baby Dodds on drums. And it's a perfect example of the early style of what jazz was before mm-hmm. Louis Armstrong broke away as solo, of that whole idea of the ensemble playing with what they were doing. We played two tracks. The first track was the very first thing ever recorded with Louis Armstrong, where he could be heard, a track called Just Gone, followed up by the second track from that same session, second recording, called Canal Street Blues, which actually has writing credits to both Joe King Oliver and Louis Armstrong. So it marks the very first time that Louis Armstrong
receives writing credit
as well on a record.
Besides the one that was stolen from him in
exactly.
the earlier show.
Right, exactly. Let me remind you that you're listening to American Hit Radio on WHPC 90.3 FM, coming to you from Nassau Community College. We're here every Wednesday and Friday from 5 until 6. I should also mention, by the way, since we're in Nassau Community, that there is an upcoming basketball game that you might be interested in knowing here on campus. The Nassau Lions are going to be playing the TCI Generals right here at Nassau Community College on Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. So if you're interested in that, come on down for the basketball game. That's Nassau Lions versus the TCI Generals, Tuesday at 6:30. Also, for us, by the way, if you're interested in what you're hearing with what we're doing with our series, the American Hit Radio Show and the Friday series, especially with How Music Changed, check out our website. You can go to shutupandlisten.com. That's shadduppandlisten.com. The previous show, of course, that we did on Louis Armstrong is there, so you could hear this entire series. You could hear the entire, 100 bazillion shows we did on Motown. You could hear the series that we did on any number of other artists, including the Beach Boys, Bob Dylan, the birth of jazz, the birth of blues.
Yeah, I think birth of jazz right into this would be a really good, smooth
Yeah, they would segue well. I think that could work, so check them out. I think you'd like to go to that. Shut Up and Listen, shadduppandlisten.com. And I believe soon we're going to finally get up to snuff on our regular website, too. You can go to our home site, which is AmericanHitRadio.com or AmericanHitNetwork.com. All right, then, getting back to this, Lewis's first recording session with King Oliver. I want to play one more track. It was the last track that they had done that day. And it's interesting in so much as it actually features Lewis's first recorded solo. Now, it's actually one of these songs that, plods along fairly nicely in a very pleasant way, and you're going to hear a bunch of different solos that are going on. It's called Chimes Blues. At one point, it was Lil Hardin who was supposed to be providing the climax of the song when she plays a piano riff that's supposed to sound like it's chimes. She's actually a little bit off time when she does it. Not a big deal, but you're going to hear the band going through the ensemble thing. But check out the last 30 seconds or so when all of a sudden Lewis rips with his first solo ever recorded. It's the type of thing where if you could imagine yourself being alive in the year 1922, that hearing this trumpet coming out of this record for just this little short bit at the end absolutely signaled something totally new and different and incredibly exciting that was happening with King Oliver's band. The track is called Chimes Blues. Here's King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band. Thank you. right there with that. That's right there. Just say, oh my God, that's it. There's something brand new happening there. And it's not, of course, just his choice of notes, but it's the fullness of his tone and it's the sheer joy that's coming out of his horn on that. You can just hear that. It's like, boy, this, it almost sounds
the
like it's
times
like,
they are changing.
Absolutely.
It's evolution. Brilliant.
Now, keep in mind also, I mean, this is at, like, as I said, the recording techniques were so crude that they were going through where they were.
Which makes it even more magnificent to think how well the sound shines.
Absolutely right. I mean,
even through the crudeness of the recording.
Right. And this is also, as you were saying earlier, Heidi, your point is really well taken. Musicians were very wary of recording back then. You know, just it provided the means for others to, like, copy their licks. You could play a record over and over again, and you could learn how to. You know, that's exactly how people learn songs now. And before anybody could do that, you didn't want anybody to know how you were getting your licks. Trumpet players would put handkerchiefs over their hands.
That's right.
To hide what they were playing. And it was also seen as potentially creating your own competition for live performances. People could stay home and listen to your records. So, like, well, I don't know if I want to do that. Besides that, musicians received no copyrights at the time, no royalties. Generally, the band got paid $25 per recording, the band, flat rate, $25. And they had to edit all their songs down to around 3 minutes while playing in a room with no approving audience that resembled more of a closet than a dance hall. And without the live atmosphere, the sex, the booze, it was hard, if not impossible, to muster up the energy of a live gig. You know, the wonder really isn't why people like Buddy Bolden or Freddie Keppard never or hardly ever recorded in the first place. The wonder is why anyone else bothered at all, really. But in a very real sense, these recordings, you know, had a similar effect on our culture that we just played, almost as the internet does today, because their very existence of Louis Armstrong doing this, and allowing people to hear him outside of his immediate area, allowed the music to spread like wildfire, and his musical ideas and the innovation spread out around the country, and it had a huge impact. There was a fledgling company called Gennett. That was where the recording was done. It was based in Richmond, Indiana, and it became ground zero for the earliest jazz recordings. Besides Louis Armstrong and King Oliver, Jelly Roll Morton recorded there. Bix Beiderbecke recorded there. Hoagy Carmichael and the New Orleans Creole Jazz Band, of course. It also featured, though, recordings by the KKK.
Weird.
Spoken word recordings. There were no black employees at the label. And there were some who were publicly known as KKK members at Gennett. So it was not a very comfortable place for these guys to go. And they knew that they weren't being treated well, but there wasn't much option around this time near Chicago for them to be recording. And it's where, for some reason, the place that was letting them come in to do this. So you can imagine how uncomfortable it must have been for them. The recordings, as I said, were acoustic, no microphones yet. So they had to play into this giant cone that resembled an oversized umbrella on its side. Playback actually came through the same method. That's exactly
right,
what the
phonograph.
Old phono players were. But while other musicians were wary, Lewis embraced the recording process. This excited him, going into the studio and recording this and hearing himself coming back. It was such a new thing. It was, for him, this was a means to spread his legacy. He learned to love recording, and eventually, obviously, as you know from later in his life, the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
He collected records, and he always kept a phonograph nearby when he was on the road, or eventually even a tape recorder when that was invented. It also helped that the early acoustic recording method greatly favored the trumpet, obviously. I mean, tuba back then was nearly impossible to record. It was just, you know, the frequency of tuba didn't work too well. Drums, the same thing. Drums would totally destroy the recording. So drummers like Baby Dodds or whoever either couldn't play at all or they were forced to play blocks back in the acoustic day. Piano was barely audible, as we just heard with Lil. How difficult it was to hear her part in a group recording. So for these recordings, as I said, Lewis was asked to stand 15 feet in back of everyone else. Now, they would have continued to go back to Indiana for a number of other recordings. And I'd like to play one more track that Lewis did at the Gennett Recording Studios in Richmond, Indiana. A song that was actually written by Lewis, and this was the first recording of his own composition that was written exclusively by Lewis, a song, again, by the Creole Jazz Band. This is called Weatherbird Rag. All right. King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band. The name of that track was Weatherbird Rag. And the thing worth keeping in mind, as I said, this was in Indiana. It was a 250-mile round trip for them to get to and from the recording studio, sometimes done in the same day as a session
they had that night.
To
play a gig, yeah.
Right. So that's all. I mean, you're thinking about 1923, excuse me. Obviously, you know, the transportation is not the most reliable. It's going to take a long time to drive 125 miles each direction to get to this thing.
Yeah, that's an all-day trip.
Exactly. Get back and then record that night. But that track we just heard was recorded the second day of the first session. They were actually staying over when they were there for 2 days.
Thank goodness.
They did go back a couple of other times. They went back later on in June. And then offers came from a bunch of other places. They did a session for Paramount in September of 1923.
And where was Paramount Studios?
That was in Chicago.
Okay.
They also recorded for OK Records right in Chicago as well. So this was much more convenient
easier.
For them.
Yeah,
much more convenient. So all of a sudden, you know, the recordings are coming, the gig, and the reputation is spreading. The band is becoming very famous. Famous people are showing up to see Lewis and King Oliver play and to see the interplay that's going on between them. And as I said, they're playing in speakeasies, and people like Bix Beiderbecke are coming in and just watching in awe. And Lewis gets to befriend him, and they become very close.
Well, jazz is very popular now at this point, right? I mean, it's getting popular. People are playing phonographs in their salons.
Absolutely, yes.
And things of that nature all over Europe even, right?
Exactly. And it's the music that is catching on. The reason I mentioned Bix Beiderbecke, though, is because, and the reason Lewis loved him so much, as I said, Lewis didn't really like to cut with people, and Bix was just not about that at all. Bix was just like this creative guy that wanted to come up with different things. So when the place would shut down, Bix would stay later, and Lewis would stay later, and he said they would just play together and just worry about inventing creative music and coming up with these beautiful ideas rather than trying to outplay each other. And Lewis said that it was some of the most creative things that he had ever done in his life, but it was just, you know, it gone into the ether because it was the two of them playing late at night, but, you know, with a couple of other guys, maybe just for the fun and the beauty of it. And problem, though, was beginning to start with the band. I mean, as their reputation grew and they became the most famous band in Chicago, the rancor began to grow between all the band members as well.
I mean, egos.
First of all, you know, Lewis's divorce from Daisy becomes final, but his relationship with Papa Joe begins to grow uncomfortable, too, because Lil starts to try to manage Lewis's life.
Mm-mm.
You know, they got married on February 5th, 1924, and Lewis finally felt, you know, grounded enough to send for his stepson, Clarence, now that he's married.
Oh.
So he comes up when he's living with them, and Lil's mother moved in as well, and Lewis is living in a really nice apartment in Chicago. He's living high. They got a grand piano in his apartment. But tensions within the band made things really difficult, especially with Lil practically forcing Lewis to quit from King Oliver, convincing him that he should get a job as a first trumpet. Shouldn't play second trumpet for anybody. Eventually, he does quit, and at first, it looked like it might have been a very bad idea as the offers were not pouring in. But we'll continue our story with what does happen with our third episode next week as we continue with part three of Lewis Armstrong, and we'll leave you with one more classic by King Oliver's Creole Jazz Band track, of course, about Lewis Armstrong, called Dippermouth Blues. Take care, everybody. See you next week. Thank you, Heidi.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Earl.